You're listening to Uncanny Landscapes, Excursions into the Otherwise, with Justin Hopper.
There are no unsacred places. There are only sacred places and desecrated places. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about those three simple little lines. And I think what Wendell Berry is referring to and what I kind of interpreted as is this idea that the whole world is sacred. So the natural world, the world that we inhabit, that, you know, that we exist on, is sacred. What we then do is we unfortunately occasionally desecrate places. I think what we also do is we recognize certain spaces as having a kind of super sacredness.
Welcome to Uncanny Landscapes, a series of conversations around and excursions into landscapes of the otherwise. Each episode features an interview with a landscape practitioner, someone whose work is rooted in the strange ways we today experience our surroundings. I am your host, Justin Hopper, and you've just heard today's guest, James Canton, discussing one of the inspirations for his book Grounded. More from James very soon. The music you hear is Leaves Rustle and the Wind in My Hair by Pefkin from the album Observations on Land and Sea, available on Pefkin's own Bandcamp. Please take a moment to subscribe to Uncanny Landscapes on Substack. It's free and includes the podcast as well as my newsletters of related topics and works in progress. Or like and subscribe on your own podcast platform. And whatever you do, tell a friend about Uncanny Landscapes, maybe a few. The Substack is kicking off with something new as of this edition. Along with the podcast and my own occasional contributions, I'm bringing in others to express their works in progress and thoughts on landscape. Today there's an essay by the artist and writer Camilla Nelson, who's been featured on the podcast before, writing about her new online course of experimental nature, landscape, and eco-writing called Becoming, Towards an Experimental Ecology of Line. Camilla's an important artist in this work, and I'm very thankful to her for contributing to the Uncanny Landscapes Substack. I hope you'll give it a read and perhaps sign up for her course. I've got some more exciting guests contributing in the next few weeks. Sign up. It's all available through uncannylandscapes.substack.com. James Canton is a writer and educator based in North Essex in England, not far from me. He's the director of the master's degree course in Wild Writing, Literature, Landscape, and the Environment at University of Essex, one of a handful of universities offering such a course in eco-literature. His books include Ancient Wonderings, Travels in Prehistoric Britain, The Oak Papers, a book about the natural world inspired by a single tree, and his latest, Grounded, A Journey into the Landscapes of Our Ancestors, which we'll discuss on the podcast. And now, talking about East Anglia, the liminal zone of England in which he and I both live, here's James Canton.
I think that's right. I mean, we kind of live in these kind of, it's like the kind of hinterlands of kind of North Essex, Suffolk, these kind of worlds. I kind of moved to, like 25 years ago now, I moved out of London. I moved out of that kind of cityscape. And, you know, it definitely took me some years to adjust and kind of find my feet, if you like, in a landscape that's a very different space to walk, a very different space to kind of get to know than the kind of urban world where you have these kind of such obvious human footprints all around you, whether it's like the concrete, it's the pavements, I mean, everything. And to obviously, on one level, even in the countryside, everything is human constructed, but it's a lot. There's a lot more of the natural landscape still present, if you like. So, yeah, you can still find trees and stuff in urban spaces, but suddenly I was out, you know, I live in a very, very small little village. It's got, you know, the only urban or the only kind of collective human spaces are a curry house and a church, you know, and that's not a million miles from lots and lots of little villages around where I live, North Essex, where you live, kind of thing. And I think what that allows you, genuinely, if you're someone that likes exploring landscape, that likes going out into the world around you, is it gives you this kind of way into a more distant kind of human topography, if you like, if I can put it like that. So it's much easier, I would argue, on one level, to step back a few thousand years and kind of get into the ways in which humans were living on this landscape a few thousand years ago, and genuinely kind of get a feel for it, a kind of an imaginative taste, because there's so many markers on this landscape that I inhabit out here in the countryside, out in the wilds, if you like, in the sticks, as we used to call it from London, you know, that is translatable to the way in which, certainly to the way in which people lived here in kind of Celtic times, kind of pre-Roman times. You know, you didn't have cities. You didn't, that the large urban concept just didn't happen. So it was only with the Romans coming into Britain, if you like, that we have even a notion of this idea of cities, or what they called civilized existence, as opposed to, you know, the people that lived before that, who were of the countryside, literally, which means pagan. I mean, that's all it means. It means pagus. It's from the root pagus. It means of the countryside. So, you know, on those levels, and as I say, you know, I didn't just walk here and go, oh my goodness, this is so enlightening. But it took a number of years of kind of recognizing this aspect of the landscape. And I mean, you mentioned the most recent book that I've published, which is Grounded, which is the subtitle is A Journey into the Landscapes of Our Ancestors. And it was kind of, yeah, it became much, much more local based landscape investigation, exploration, kind of practice, largely because the bulk of it was written during lockdown. So there were like genuine practical reasons why it was kind of, for many years, it had been known to me and like my mates that I would chat to about it as the Sacred Spaces book, you know, because it was about getting to know aspects of the landscape where humans I would recognize a more kind of spiritual significance to a particular space or a particular place. And of course, what happened during lockdown is we had to, you know, that space, the landscape that I could explore was shrunk dramatically. So obviously we're very fortunate out in the countryside that we had a little bit more flexibility with our movements. But I've got, you know, well, in fact, it's nearly finally died, but I've got a really aged Muddy Fox mountain bike that I kind of use, and it has like one gear, and I could get about 5 miles comfortably. So you kind of notice that there's a kind of significant part of the book that's about an intense investigation, if you like, into a kind of 5 mile zone of my immediate home, in this kind of small village of Little Maplestead in North Essex. So yeah, very much Grounded is very much kind of based around that small kind of rural countryside of North Essex, where on one level not much happens, and I'm kind of very happy with that, in the sense that that doesn't create a kind of modern noise that can kind of get in the way of when you're trying to do this seeing into the kind of the deep past, if you like. So yeah, you're allowed the space and the scope, whether, you know, whatever the weather is like out there, what, you know, whatever's going on, it doesn't change that much. So I, you know, I can still get my maps out at home in the dry. I can do my research here, and then I can kind of go out. As it was, as I say, most of it was, or a bulk of the book was written during that first lockdown period. And so, you know, May 2020 or whatever it was actually the most stunning spring that we had for many years. So it was a kind of contrasting practice, in the sense that there was obviously hideous human impact event taking place around me. But in fact, what it had allowed me personally was to open up the lands around me to to me delving into deeper aspects of that kind of cultural landscape.
The word you use in the introduction is numinous, this idea of seeking out these numinous landscapes and finding these personally significant and personally spiritual, as well as these places that have a kind of known legacy. And you know, the markers that you talk about a little bit later. But I wonder if we can, just sticking to the lockdown kind of theme, do you think that affected what felt spiritual to you? Do you think that what affected you as being a spiritual place that you might remark upon was different than it would have been had you gone through this process in what we once might have thought of as normal times?
It's an interesting point, really, in the sense that I think what we were all forced to do during that period was to kind of question what was, not only what was important to us, but what was important to us in our immediate vicinity. So, you know, you found that individual humans bonded with their local humans. So we made friends with neighbors that we might have had just a passing, cursory kind of association with. I think that was quite a powerful essence. But I think in some ways, the kind of personal markers on my immediate landscape were already present. They were already present. And what lockdown did was it allowed me both the time and the space to dig deeper into some of them. So, you know, so for example, there's a site that I go to. So my local church is Little Maplestead Church, and it's a Crusader church. It's pretty kind of significant in that it's known as a round church. It was founded by, you know, Crusaders returning from Jerusalem. The Knights Hospitallers were a particular kind of order. They were seen as these kind of relatively enlightened knights. So they used their swords, but they set up hospitals. That was supposedly the deal. I don't think I'd have liked to have met them as a fighting Muslim at that time. But, you know, this was the deal. And they came back. So this is my local church. It's kind of like within the churches of Britain, it has its place, you know, and people come and visit it. It's very busy. So I was, it's one of the two, as I say, you know, human markers that I can walk to in my village. So, you know, we tend to, on local walks, we tend to do the same kind of ritual walks. And I like that process. I really like that myself. So for many years, I mean, I've been living in this house for, since 2000. So for many years I've been here, and one of my standard local walks was to the church. And then weirdly, I would go just beyond the kind of the graveyard walls, if you like, or hedge walls, the hedges rather. And I would stand just beyond, looking out over the fields that run beautifully down. They have a kind of a little Tuscany feel to them, the running down to the River of the Colne. And, that would be a place that I would kind of go to anyway. So it kind of been established in my own cultural landscape, my immediate landscape, my personal landscape. And it would be a place where I'd remember my father, who died many years ago. So he had no association with this place at all. But I guess it was just a place where I would go, have a little moment of kind of calm thought, you know, that kind of meditative space that people would talk about, you know. And so it was already a marker on my land, for where I would, in particular, kind of meet my father or chat with dad, you know, kind of just have that thought. And I would kind of, I didn't necessarily talk about this with many people, but, you know, when I did, I'd find that people would say, oh yeah, that's interesting, because when I walk the dog, I tend to stop at this tree, you know, and I you know, the dog likes the tree, and I'm happy to have a couple of minutes there. And I often just have a moment of reflection there. So I think it's a very human trait. And I think, again, the thing is, obviously, if you're doing such activity in the countryside, you're often a bit more immersed in nature, though, in fact, again, you know, you mentioned how did lockdown affect the kind of sense and sensibility, if you like, of the book. And I think it did. I think it accentuated that feeling, if you like. And it's certainly, you know, we know this, don't we, that across, you know, so many human worlds, we were kind of felt this desire to be in nature, if you like. I mean, we're always of nature. We should never forget that. But to be in the natural landscape, you know, so there were, I actually had a book out kind of at that time on oak papers. So it was called The Oak Papers. And it was all about connection with ancient oak trees. And, you know, and I think it kind of hit a bit of a feeling amongst lots of people, because they appreciated this idea that there was something intrinsic about being human and connecting to aspects of the natural world. And particularly, obviously, you know, the most significant markers in our immediate landscape. And suddenly, you know, with lockdown, you're not charging off to go and see Stonehenge. You're not, you know, going to the seaside for a holiday. We were all forced to see what was beautiful and significant around us, and myself too, as I say. So that definitely came into the book, and I really genuinely believe that in a lot of ways the book was improved by me doing this kind of deep, close focus on the immediate, on my immediate local landscape. And then, you know, to a certain extent, what happened was when we were freed for a brief period in the kind of June period, by then I'd done a certain amount of that work and, like all of us, wanted to spread my wings again. So kind of headed off to one of the sacred space markers I had in mind, which was actually West Kennet Long Barrow, this kind of incredibly powerful and amazing site down in the West Country, one of the markers of the first farmers of in Britain had created. So by then I was kind of ready to leave my immediate nest, if you like.
That story about your father, about connecting with your father and having this this space in which you know, it's not his grave, it's not his favorite place, it's not his favorite walk, it's not any of those things. And yet it's this location where you have a significance of that relationship. In Grounded, we're talking about, you kind of position that, and then things like West Kennet Long Barrow that everybody knows.
Yeah.
And in between them, some of these places, like in Wormingford, there were Wormingford being in right on the border between Essex and Suffolk, and famous for John Nash and Ronald Blythe, right? There's a short bit where you're looking at these round barrows, essentially, mm-hmm. these ancient burial sites.
Yeah.
And the connection between those kinds of things makes it more apparent how natural an act these markers are. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between what we do mm-hmm. and some of the things that interested you about what people in the Neolithic era were doing?
This is sort of one of the lessons I think I learned, is that, you know, as humans in the 21st century or whatever, it can be easy sometimes with our kind of smart technology, or this kind of, even cars, the idea of cars that you could just jump into your personal vehicle and speed off somewhere, you know. But there's so many ways in which I feel, as you know, connection to our ancient ancestors who didn't necessarily charge off to places, but would still travel distances, would still do a lot of what we would do in terms of like marking land. Even when you go back pre Neolithic, which are the first farmers, that's the Neolithic, if you just think of as the first farmers, really. And they were the people that really would mark the land with stone, etc. Yeah. But even before that, you go back into the, you know, the hunter-gatherer periods of sort of, you know, 6,000 beyond BC, 6,000 years ago, etc., and on. And you get into these far harder to pin down, but these landscapes that these people would clearly marking. I mean, we've got obviously the evidence of it is far less because they weren't moving big stones and then leaving them a few thousand years for us to go, oh, look at that. But absolutely. And I think, you know, whether it's the practice of going to a particular place where we remember one of our, you know, our lost loved ones, or whether we go to a place that's a kind of communal space where we do that process of being human and marking somewhere on the landscape. There's beautiful ways in which you can connect to the whole idea with being human. And I think importantly as well, remind yourself of the connection with landscape, with the natural world, with these worlds that are beyond our own kind of narcissistic, human, consumerist spaces that we kind of now largely inhabit for, 99 point whatever percent of our existence. And in a lot of ways, we realize, or we're starting to realize, hopefully, that it's not that healthy for us to just inhabit those human spaces, that it's good to step out. And those are, I think that's one of the lessons from our ancestors that we can learn. And it's one of the practices that I love doing. So, you mentioned Wormingford there, which is beautiful village out on the Essex-Suffolk borders. And in Grounded, I sort of tell about going wandering off there, seeking these round barrows, these kind of Bronze Age round barrows, which you can find because amazingly it's kind of mix of kind of modern technology where you can literally look at kind of crop markings that are mapped out from satellite imagery or whatever. You can go on your Google Maps and trace your local landscape, and you can see these weird circles in the fields, and they mark these sites of burial, these sacred sites from 4,000 years ago or so, or even further. So that was sort of one of these kind of practices that I would happily do. And unfortunately, I had a couple of mates that were happy to do it, so I wasn't entirely the kind of lone outcast wandering around on my own in the fields. I had a couple of friends too, which is always, good. It's always good if you can kind of combine it with a kind of connection with other humans, I think, as well, partly. But yeah, as we say, places like West Kennet, further away down in the West Country, is a beautiful example of a little bit further back in time from the Bronze Age to those first farmers. So that dates to sort of 3650 BC, something around there, and is this practice where the first farmers were clearing the land, if you like, for practical reasons. They were now, instead of wanting to walk through landscapes and kind of mark it and hunt, gather, etc., kind of they more strictly were kind of creating fields. And what one of the practices was to gather the larger stones, if you like, into these sites of significance, where often they would not just kind of, I mean, we often think they're places where people would stick their dead and then kind of, seal them up like a tomb, but it was kind of a lot more interactive than that. So again, these stories that emerge from the distant past are fascinating, and again kind of challenge our assumptions as to how we say relate to our dead, relate to our own lost loved ones, if you like. So there's clear evidence that they were, say, potentially going in, taking some of the larger bones from their ancestors and maybe taking them out for a while, keeping them in their homes, because they weren't living there. They weren't living in these stone settlements, these stone markers. They were living in their own settlements. And there's evidence that the larger bits of bones were being moved about, maybe, potentially being moved to different sites, which again is kind of weird because we're very much like, once you're dead, you get placed in one space and you really don't move from there, whether you're buried or you're burnt, kind of thing. I guess there's the idea of scattering ashes, etc. But we can learn a lot, I think, about the way in which we are as humans by seeing those distant and ancient practices.
And you tell this story about Roland Taylor in Hadley, Suffolk, and talk about, you know, the, well, maybe you could tell us, maybe you could tell us briefly about who Roland Taylor was and what your experience of his story within the land of Hadley is. And this idea of places losing some of their, what we might consider quote unquote natural beauty because of human actions within those spaces.
Yeah, I find that idea of the kind of the sacred land and then a desecrated land, I think that's really interesting. So the Wendell Berry kind of quote is about this idea, there are no unsacred places, there are only sacred places and desecrated places. And I've spent a lot of time thinking about those three simple little lines. And I think what Wendell Berry is referring to and what I kind of interpreted as is this idea that the whole world is sacred. So the natural world, the world that we inhabit, that, you know, that we exist on, is sacred. And I like that. I really like that. And then the idea, obviously, is that as humans operating on this landscape, what we then do is we unfortunately occasionally desecrate places, and that has a kind of impact through time, I guess, is the way to see this. And I would kind of extend the quote a little bit further in the sense that I think what we also do is we recognize certain spaces as having a kind of super sacredness, if I can kind of call it that. So on the kind of dark side, if you like, is this idea. And Ronald Blythe, who's a brilliant kind of writer on a number of these kind of areas, talks about the black map of Britain that you can draw, where you have these sites of religious persecution and murder, and execution, etc., etc., torture, execution, like these hideous kind of human acts carried out. And I kind of felt that in a book like Grounded that I was writing, that was about, to a certain extent, exploring sacred and spiritual spaces on the landscape, that I needed to also not ignore this notion of the kind of desecration. I went to, there was a site that I went to a number of times, Oldham Common, which is just outside the town of Hadley in Suffolk. And it relates to, there's a beautiful marker there, actually. It's really worthwhile going to. It's a stone obelisk that was put up there by the people of Hadley to mark this site where, and you're going back a bit. So you're going back to 1555. Obviously, nothing compared to a lot of the kind of returns to the Bronze Age, to the Neolithic, etc. But it's still, you know, the best part of 500 years. And it goes back into a time where you had these kind of religious persecutions. This is a site that marks where a kind of religious Protestant figure, Roland Taylor, was essentially burnt at the stake. And I traced not only the kind of the story of Roland Taylor himself, but also you could trace quite comfortably. It's amazing what you're able to do with a little bit of research and time on your hands. It could trace his journey over, like, he was held in London, you know, he was from Hadley, he was then, you know, taken to London because he committed these hideous acts of leading the service in English rather than Latin, and was kind of was taken to London, was tried, you know, yeah, you're going to be burnt at the stake, and then brought back, and in this kind of incredible journey as well. I really wanted to do the kind of classic thing, you know, kind of walk it myself. He was kind of led on horse. And he stopped at Chelmsford for a while, and then he was taken up to Bury, and then, you know, this whole Bury St Edmunds, this is, and then finally was kind of brought back hooded, you know, in this strange kind of hood. So he apparently couldn't see out, brought back to his home, to his town of Hadley, and then marched up this hill to Aldham Common. And it's, you know, I mean, and where he was then burnt at the stake. And there's a whole story about that goes with him being burnt at the stake as well, which was fascinating to go into, because he knew a number of the people around him. So they took the hood off and were kind of tying him to this stake, you know, in a barrel of tar or whatever. And he recognized someone and sort of said, "Oh, Souse, what are you doing here?" And he said, "Well, you know, do you want my boots? You know, when I'm gone, I'm not going to need my boots." And this guy was like, "Yeah, you know." And it ended up actually, you know, there's a crowd there. You know, it's like it's sort of fireworks night or something. It's a hideous version of fireworks night. But that he's there. And instead of dying really painfully through being set fire and burnt at the stake, this guy Souse actually kind of knocks him out with a halberd and sort of saves him at least from the agony of this. So this was a sort of fascinating journey to go on to explore this kind of idea of desecration of a site. I obviously walked to the marker in outside of Hadley, strangely on a very cold day where no one was around, and there was this, you know, it's down the side of a hedge, and you kind of, it felt like a site of desecration, but obviously I knew that, you know, whether that affected my feelings, etc. But it would have been easy in some ways to then say, okay, I could trace, can I trace any other sites of desecration around me, you know, because humans can be really quite brutal beings, as we know, you know. And I just thought, well, this isn't going to be much fun. If I'm deliberately looking for markers, and I could have done more of that, you know, not to be kind of flippant, but I find it intriguing and fascinating how we mark the land. And one of the things that's happened in the last sort of 30, 40 years, possibly, is that we have these now markers where people die in road accidents, in car crashes. And often they're very poignant, and there are often, you know, you can go to these sites where you have these sort of bunches of faded flowers or even faded plastic flowers, you know, these kind of faded photos. And, you know, near me there's a very sad site where there's an oak tree that bears the marks of a crash from, you know, 2015, I think it was now. So again, you know, I could have spent my time going down this journey into sites of desecration on the local landscape, and I guess you could play that up into a kind of gothic, a nightmare of going to, you know, sites of kind of mass desecration, if I can put it like that. I'm sure we could think of some around Britain, you know, but what. It wasn't what I wanted to be doing with the book, you know. It was a kind of delving into notions of sacredness, certainly, and the Wendell Berry quote was fascinating to show the kind of antithesis of that, the idea of the desecrated site. But what I was more interested in is finding those super sacred sites, so where for thousands and thousands of years we have evidence that humans have gone there and in some way marked that as a place they want to gather, they want to, whether it's celebrate or whatever they get up to. It might be a place where they mark the dead. It might be a place where they can look out over a landscape for whatever reasons. And often that, though, all those kind of ideas coalesce.
And so, I think that, you know, one of the things that that you said in the Roland Taylor location in Hadley is and I might be getting this wrong, but I think that it said that the place had lost some of its natural beauty because of this event. And that's an idea that I find really fascinating, that you know, because we think of beauty as these two things that are completely at odds with one another. Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and beauty is being this, you know, Grecian urn kind of truth. And the idea that because you know, England in particular, Britain only slightly less so, is such a small amount of space that all of these sites are sacred and desecrated. You know, something dreadful has happened everywhere you go, and something dreadful has been visited upon others everywhere you go. And I really like this idea that each of these locations holds both of that within it, and it's whichever one we decide to conjure up. Do you think that it's safe to say that context is part of what makes a place, an object of nature, beautiful to us? That sacredness that we imbue by knowledge of its shared, like, reciprocal spirituality, is that something that we should more thoroughly investigate as being part of what we see as being natural beauty?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, I think that notion of natural beauty is to a certain extent is almost always constructed. It's almost always forged by, it depends how you see it, but, you know, say go back to, I don't know, the romantic vision of, you know, Wordsworth or something, or the way in which we can see the Lake District or something, and we say, oh my God, it's so beautiful. That's not a natural landscape. That is a human constructed version of what that land kind of would look like, or perhaps should look like, if we as humans were kind of less invasive as a species, if you like. So absolutely, that we must be very careful, I suggest, with the way that we kind of see landscape as kind of lovely. Oh, isn't that lovely? And it, you know, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and that's fine. But I think often what we do, if we are kind of crass and kind of simplistic in our observations of landscape, is that we miss some of the complexity, and we miss also our sense of connection with the natural landscape. What we're seeing is human constructions of beauty and landscape. So, you know, whether that's, not to get into the whole sheep issue, if people love sheep, I mean, I quite like sheep, but, you know, the idea that you know, we love grazed landscapes, kind of large lawns over huge areas of landscapes in Britain and Scotland, you know, and Wales, etc. You know, that's not, it's kind of, it's gone. We no longer, it's not a healthy landscape. It's not a good landscape from ecological perspectives. And yet that has become embedded in, to a certain extent, in our, you know, kind of modern psyche, modern English British psyche of what's beautiful. You know, if you go up to, say, the southern, you know, southern parts of the Highlands of Scotland, for example, and you kind of go, oh, these are really beautiful landscapes, etc. You know, largely, let's not forget, these were lands that were largely cleared of humans, like the workers, the people that worked the lands, by the people that owned them, in order to put sheep on there because they would get more money for that. And they didn't care at all about what happened to the humans. So maintaining this kind of a spirit of desecration, if you like, you could argue that the huge swathes of what now are considered beautiful landscapes are actually desecrated landscapes. You know, and I've walked certain parts of, like, what are called kind of coffin roads, in that you can walk, say, I remember walking one in the Outer Hebrides. The one markers, literally markers, but made by humans, where they had to carry their dead from the land, from the kind of stony lands where they'd been moved to or had to clear to, across these landscapes that had been altered irrevocably by this new import of sheep and stuff that would get more money for the landowners. So, you know, it's very, the more simplistic you look at landscape and kind of see sort of simple beauty, if you like, as human constructed, the more problematic it is in so many ways. Ecological, you know, desecration index is increasing massively. So, you know, we have to be careful. But weirdly, you know, you take a group of, say, school children or humans out into the woods, say, ancient woodland. Take them out into ancient woodland. And we always tend to have a nice time out there. We feel comfortable there. We're happy there. I'm not suggesting that they're necessarily sacred in that sense, but I am suggesting they're sacred in the sense, in that Wendell Berry sense, that all is sacred. They're not super sacred, but even within that ancient woodland, you know, you take kids there, they're all going to grab a stick, go and look for some stones to throw, et cetera, et cetera. You take older humans there, and they tend to gather around the ancient oak tree or something like that and enjoy physically connecting with that, those super sacred markers on the natural landscape. So
we know what to do, in other words.
We know what to do. We know what to do. But yeah, we also appreciate that that is a beautiful landscape, to go back to your question, your long distant question, I'm afraid, sorry. But I think more and more what we need to perhaps do to ourselves as humans is re-educate ourselves on what is natural beauty, perhaps, and that the idea that often natural beauty is the lesser impact of humans on the landscape. The wild writing is a master's program that's run at the University of Essex, and that I've been teaching on since 2009, and now I'm the director of, so I run it now, basically. And the subtitle says much. It's wild writing, literature, landscape, and the environment. So it's very much about landscapes, environments, very much about everything that we've been talking about the ways in which humans interact with landscapes, the natural landscapes, ecologies, everything from kind of, I don't know, dung beetles to what? To duns or something like that, to the way in which humans exist on these landscapes. So it covers a lot of ground, and it's very much, we've very much enjoyed having students from genuinely all over the world, because it's quite an unusual course. It's interdisciplinary, so you do lots of stuff where you're looking at textbooks, books of literature is what I want to go to. So some of the kind of key core books are things like J.A. Baker's The Peregrine from 1967, which is a kind of classic of nature writing, English nature writing, and is kind of one of the forerunners of what's now called new nature writing. People like Helen MacDonald, with her H's for Hawk, that she gets in there. People like Rob McFarlane, for a number of his texts, you know. So these are the kind of layers of literature that we have. And then we have, you know, there's all kinds of like more recent writers. There's someone I'm really interested to get on the course, Noreen Massoud, who's A Flat Place, is a brilliant kind of recent wild writing book, as I would call it, perhaps. So yeah, it's a program that attracts all kinds of people to it, from biological scientists to kind of poets, let's say.
So what would be an actual like class that you might teach? Mm-hmm. I mean, that sounds really like a very stupid question, but
not stupid at all. I mean, yeah. Often we often say begin in a seminar room, but you know, we are kind of constrained by walls occasionally. So we might be, say, studying a text. So I've mentioned J.A. Baker's The Peregrine. That's one of the core texts on one of the, you know, compulsory modules, new nature writing. So we say, look at that text in class. We have the archive of J.A. Baker at the University of Essex, that arrived a few years ago, which has been great. You know, that flew in, if you like. And and so we take the students, explore the archive, look at Baker's maps, etc. And then Baker was very much an Essex man. He was, you know, lived in Chelmsford most of his life. So what we then do is, actually the week after, we'll be going out on a field trip. So part of the wild writing is very much a kind of what we call the outdoor classroom in some of our BAMF, you know, this idea of like genuinely getting out into landscape, getting out into spaces and places, often with a particular focus. So that would be to go, I'm just arranging it actually, that we're going to go to Little Baddow, a little village down in Essex near Chelmsford, where Baker would cycle to, and he would do, and he'd, you know, keep on looking for these, the last remaining peregrines of Essex in the 1950s and 1960s. So I've done this field trip a number of times with students, and we go out, we kind of trace the text on the landscape very much, almost specifically. So on page 62, it mentions, a big house in the distance or something like this. And then we're like, is that it? You know, so there's a lot of that going on. That's one of the kind of formats that we try to do. So in class, looking at material, and then getting out into the landscape as well.
That's brilliant. That does sound fun.
Yeah, it's really fun. I have to say, I do really enjoy it. It's a great module, the new nature writing. But the MA itself, as I say, it does attract people from all different disciplines. So, you know, we get a lot of people that are there to kind of develop their creative practice. So they're looking to become a more, you know, published writers, or, you know, develop their time, give themselves some time to do it. And then we have people that work on far more on the critical side. So they're analyzing text, they're looking at the way in which people write about landscape and the natural world, and then they're putting their inflection on that. They're kind of exploring aspects, and it can, you know, bounce them on to doing a PhD or something like that. So yeah, it's a good balancing course, and it's interesting to see it evolve since 2009, in the sense that, you know, as humans, I think our humans in the West, perhaps, but the way that our relationship with the natural world is evolving as well. So,
and I know of at least one student who's gone on to quite a sort of illustrious writing career recently, but you know, obviously people go on to do all kinds of different things, but you've got a few people who've published after it and so.
Oh yeah, yeah, definitely. It really helps. It's definitely a kind of scaffolding to becoming a published writer. We've had people that have gone on to do PhDs. We've had, as you say, people that have been successfully published. And then, you know, that's on one side, the kind of writing side. Other people go on to be kind of environmental activists. They go into kind of someone quite early on went back when they were from the States, and they went back to, and they worked in Washington with a kind of environmental think tank kind of thing. So again, you know, it's the thing is, I think it's a slightly sort of unique master's course. So what it allows you to do as a student is to sort of say, look, I'm kind of a little bit unusual in a good way. You know, when you're looking at employability options further down the line, I think that certainly has been the case. So it's really fascinating. It's great for me to run.
Imagine.
I get to meet some fantastic people that are doing massive good work on all kinds of environmental angles. One of the modules you can do is you can do a kind of like a work placement module. So you go, and so I've placed people with all kinds of organizations, from National Trust and, you know, Essex Wildlife Trust, and then, you know, even far more esoteric organizations that are kind of help guide individuals in what aspect of relating to landscape and nature that they require.
I'm quite taken with the idea that people working in those kinds of positions be given a background in the writing and in the literature that shapes our ideas of the way we see these places. That seems really fascinating to me, and I feel like it's something that a lot of the a lot of sectors outside of the sort of environmental, you know, obviously it'd be great if we had someone who was prime minister who'd been on the wild writing course.
Yeah. It would be great. It really would be great. Maybe one day.
Thank you for listening to Uncanny Landscapes. We'll be back soon with the next installment. My guest has been writer and educator James Canton. For more about James and his new book Grounded, check out his website at jamescanton.co.uk. The music has been Leaves Rustle and The Wind in My Hair, from the album Observations on Land and Sea by Pefkin, also known as Gail Brogan, one half of the luminous experimental folk duo Bird Ellen. For more, check out Pefkin on Bandcamp. The Uncanny Landscape's title theme is by the Bellbury Poly, and the icon is by Stefan Musgrove. I'm Justin Hopper. You can follow me on Instagram, @OldWeirdAlbion, and subscribe to this podcast's free cousin Substack, where you can also find today's essay by Camilla Nelson. It's helpfully also called uncannylandscapes.substack.com. Finally, all the links I've just mentioned are on the Substack or the Uncanny Landscapes anchor page, which is uncannylandscapes.podbean.com. More installments coming soon, including interviews with field recordist Jez Riley French, musician Laura Cannell, artist Tony Haywood, and more. If you've enjoyed this and other episodes, please subscribe to the Substack and like, rate, and share the podcast, or just tell a like-minded friend or two. Thanks for listening.
Mm-hmm.